So I want to talk about wisdom, that third pillar. Then we'll have some time for just some discussion, and we'll close. Wisdom or insight can, of course, mean many things. And in one sense, it's the natural consequence of seeing more clearly. When we're not projecting so much and we don't have so many preconceptions and we don't have so many conclusions, we have a better sense of what's going on. And that can be very, very deep. So again, my friend Bob Thurman, who seems to be with us this weekend somehow, he likes the word realistic. In terms of a description of the Buddha's teaching, it's realistic. We come to a sense of what's realistic, what's real. Now, that doesn't sound very glamorous or exciting, but it's kind of cool to be realistic, to be in harmony with reality, to see things as they are rather than being so lost. And of course, one of the things about assumptions is that we don't always realize we're making them. They really serve as a kind of veil between ourselves and the reality of a living situation. So sometimes I tell the story about, I have a friend who's a sculptor. Do we say sculptress anymore, or do we just say sculptor? Anyway, she's a something. She's a sculptor or a sculptress. And she told me one day that she was going to have a piece exhibited in one of the branches of the Smithsonian Museum in D.C., the National Portrait Gallery. And I was, of course, very excited for her. And I was also going to D.C. and staying with another friend who at the time lived very close to the National Portrait Gallery. So one day I went over there looking for my friend's piece. And, you know, it being a Smithsonian branch, that means like these huge corridors, you know, and this sort of cavernous place. And I walked up and down and up and down and up and down looking for her piece. I could not find it anywhere. And my mind went all the way to just my luck. I have to be the one to tell her. They didn't put it up after all. It's like sitting in a basement someplace. And I walked up and down and up and down looking for it. And then at one point, I just kind of casually looked over my shoulder, and there it was up against the wall. And I had just made the assumption that it was going to be a freestanding piece in the middle of the exhibition space. And I must have walked by that thing, I don't know, 15 times. And never once occurred to me that it might be up on a wall. That's an example, right? Our assumptions contour what we look at, what we overlook, what we perceive, how we perceive. And we don't even necessarily realize that they're having an effect on us. That's why we call them assumptions. So the more conscious we become, the more mindful we become of what we're thinking, what we're feeling, how we're reacting, the better chance we have to see that maybe there's a construct, there's an overlay, there's an assumption at work here. What would it be like if I didn't assume that I was going to fail? Or I didn't assume this was going to happen or that was going to happen. And so we have that opportunity because we can see more clearly. The more we pay attention, the closer we come to the reality of a situation. And the insight that derives from that is on a lot of different levels. Maybe we never realized, you know, it could be quite personal insight. Maybe we never realized we were as upset about something as it turns out that we are until we looked more clearly at our reaction. Maybe we have an insight about the layers within an emotion. So maybe we look at desire or greed, and we discover a lot of loneliness inside that. Or we look at our anger and we discover a lot of sadness inside that. Or we have an insight about the way a certain emotion operates, predominantly operates within us, the way I describe my experience of fear. Seeing that I'm largely afraid, not when I feel I'm facing the unknown, I feel more afraid when I think I do know. And I tell myself these terrible stories about how things are going to work out, or not work out, more literally. And it's that that tends to incite much more fear inside me. Those are all insights that are very personal to our experience of life. What do we think is going to make us happy? We can take a look at that. How much of that has been given to us? And how much of that is really our own sense of what we might need? What are the ways in which we judge ourselves or forgive ourselves? There's so many things that we get insights about through paying attention, through being more mindful. We also talk about insight in the sense of kind of universal insights, qualities of life, characteristics of life that are said to be shared by everything. And so as we pay more careful attention to our experience in a kind of cleaner way, you know, without so much holding on and pushing away and so on, then we have the chance to see more deeply. So let's go back to the example of anger that I was using earlier. Mostly when we feel a lot of anger, we get primarily interested in the object, the provocation, the incident that sparked the anger. And it could be at ourselves too, you know, whatever that might be. And that's where our attention goes, that's where our energy goes. But if we pivot, if we look at the anger itself, not thinking I've got to get rid of this, and or I've got to enhance this, or I've got to do this for that, but what is it? What's this feeling? That's the practice of mindfulness. So again, my teacher Manindra, who also seems to be with us here this weekend, one of the times he came to the Insight Meditation Society to teach, I was sitting, and I was experiencing a lot of anger. And this too was maybe, let's say, 6 years after I began my meditation practice. So I really thought, well, surely I should be done with this by now. And I wasn't that pleased at what I was experiencing. And I'm sure he could tell, he could assess that from the way I was describing it. And so he said, this is how you should be with your anger. And IMS is a, you know, it's a building with a large kind of sloping lawn down to the street, which is called Pleasant Street, nicely enough. So Manindra said, this is how you should be with your anger. Imagine a spaceship has landed on the front lawn, and these Martians come out, and they come up to you, and they say, what is anger? What is anger? Not it's right, it's wrong, I've got to do this about it, I've got to make it go away, but what is anger? What's it feel like in my body? What's its nature? What's the play of emotion that is actually making up the anger? The sadness, the fear, the helplessness, the vengefulness, whatever it might be. What's the nature of anger? Just looking at it. We talked about this earlier. Anger has energy, which is a very positive thing. It also has a quality of compression, of tunnel vision. When you're really angry at yourself, do you ever remember anything good about yourself? No, because everything is in that state of collapse, compression. I'm terrible. I did this thing, right? So we're looking at the very nature of anger. That's all insight. And what we discover in looking at it is that in those moments of sadness, moments of fear, moments of helplessness, moments of rage, there is constant change. As solid and impermeable and oppressive as the anger might have felt or seemed when it first came up, if we really look at it, it's a moving, shifting, changing state, because everything is. And it doesn't mean that if we act on it, it's not going to have consequences. It doesn't mean it has no feeling tone. It does mean it's constantly changing. It doesn't mean it's not going to come back in 10 seconds. Maybe it will. But within itself, it's not solid. It's always changing, because everything is always changing. So in a way, we kind of deconstruct experientially all of our experience. It's what one of my friends, who's a musician, once told me. He said, in music, we would call it taking apart the chord. So that's what we're doing. We're looking at experience carefully, accurately, wholeheartedly, not with resentment, not with evasion, not with being consumed by it, and we see constant change. In the Chinese tradition, they say, if you want to understand the nature of water, look at the waves. So we look at the waves of the mind to understand the essential nature of the mind. We can look at anything and see change, if in fact it's a universal characteristic. How could it be otherwise? Otherwise, we're saying, well, you're only going to get an insight into change if you look at something beautiful. You know, it's not going to be changing, essentially changing, if it's something painful. But the suggestion, anyway, is that everything shares the nature of change, insubstantiality, coming and going. And therefore, it only makes sense that we can use anything as a vehicle for seeing that very thing. It's going to be there. How could it not? It's like saying we should have a wave without any water. So we use anything at all. Now, it's true. If somebody stopped me on my way in here and said, would you rather deeply understand the nature of change by looking at bliss and joy and serenity, or pain and anxiety and sleepiness, I'd say, I'll take the bliss. But so far, no one's given us a menu, right? So the point is that even though, of course, as human beings, we have preferences, in terms of wisdom, in terms of insight, it actually doesn't matter. Because we can deeply see the truth about life, whether we're looking at bliss and serenity and joy, or anxiety, sleepiness, and pain. So on that level, everything is useful. Everything can bring us closer to some very powerful understandings about the nature of things. So that understanding about change isn't just academic or theoretical. It changes us because it's on a different level. When we get into, as we do get into, that kind of hope that, okay, once I get a new apartment, I will be finally perfectly happy forever. Once I get this thing, this relationship, this car, this experience, it will give me final fulfillment. Whatever it is, right? And it's that sense of somehow I'm going to be able to make something unchanging that leads us astray. It's like this misplaced kind of hope or faith. If I only hold on tight enough. So the Buddha used this very kind of fun, I think sort of homey example. He said, if you hold on tightly to that which must inevitably change, It's like holding on tightly to a revolving wheel. At some point or another in the cycle, you're going to get run over. So we get some echo of that in our lives, and what do we tend to do? We tend to hold on even tighter, thinking that's going to make it work. So that kind of attachment, clinging, wanting, is the source of so much pain. Not because it's bad, and not because we're bad people, but because it's at variance with reality. It's like knocking your head against the wall. Sometimes I tell the story about I had a friend who had never been to the East Coast before. And she lived in California. And she called me one day and said, I'm going to come visit. And this was the autumn. It was the fall in Massachusetts. And it happened to have been a glorious, beautiful, splendid autumn with the leaves on the trees were just gorgeous and all these incredible colors. And I was so excited that she was going to come for the first time and see what I would call a real autumn for the first time. And so at IMS, at the retreat center, or just around there, there's this 3-mile walk on the road that people often will do after lunch. So I'd be walking on that road, and I'd look at those gorgeous, beautiful leaves on the trees, and I'd think, you better stay up there. You know, she's not coming for like another week and a half, and it would just be dreadful if she came here, and it was her very first autumn, and all the leaves were already down on the ground. And I said, you better stay up there. And then I'd walk the next day, and I'd have the same thought, you better stay up on those trees. And then one day she called me and she said, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it after all. And one of my first feelings was one of relief. I thought, oh, now I can let the leaves fall from the trees, right? So we can live at quite a variance to how things actually are. When we're lost in this idea of control, we'll yield permanence. But the opposite of that isn't some cold, uncaring state. It doesn't mean we don't try to make things happen. It doesn't mean we don't connect or appreciate or want anything. It's not like that. It's that extra thing we do when we're confused. Right? I can somehow make this never change. This experience, this person, this body, this life. Whatever it might be. So it's so painful. It's not bad, but it's awfully painful to be living in such a weird way. And we all are conditioned to do exactly that. If we hold on, we will have totems against change and death. If we do this, we'll be in control. So the more we look carefully, the more wisdom we generate, the more we're changed by that wisdom, so that maybe we can enjoy things really more fully, but without that extra thing of the clinging. Or we can understand we're not in control and we do everything that we can, but without that kind of final feeling of frustration because we can't dominate. Right? Another insight would be the sense of interconnection. And it's really just the same kind of thing. The exercise we did, I guess, yesterday, when I said, think of the people who are involved and you're sitting here in this room right now. Did we do it yesterday or Friday night? Anyway, yesterday. We're all here because of these connections. Somebody told us about their meditation practice or this organization, or they gave us a book, or they were coming themselves and they said, come, or whatever it is, right? There was no one who just popped in here out of nowhere. because we're all part of some kind of web. And this moment in time, just like every single moment in time, is an example of all these conditions coming together and coming apart. So as conditions come together, we have an experience. As they come apart, it shifts and changes. And the experience itself becomes part of the new set of conditions for the next moment, for the next occurrence. But for however alone we might feel, or cut off we might feel, the truth is actually that we are all connected, just this part of this incredible fabric of life. And that's not sentimental, it's not romantic, it's not made up, it's not saccharine, it's not designed to make us conflict avoidant or afraid of difficult feelings. It's actually how things are, that all of our lives have something to do with one another. And I think we live in such an interesting time because it doesn't have to be like a spiritual understanding that brings us there. Environmental consciousness shows us this. Economics shows us this. Even epidemiology shows us this, that what happens over there doesn't nicely stay over there. It ripples out over here. And what happens over here, what we do, it matters. Because it ripples out in all directions, right? Do you remember the movie Contagion? And I've talked about this here before in Seattle. It was a movie, a friend of mine was a technical advisor on the film, so he brought me to the opening in New York, and it is basically a film which they modeled out. He's a doctor and an epidemiologist, and so they modeled out the situation where basically on day one, someone in Hong Kong has a really bad day, and day four, half the earth is wiped out. And it wasn't just like fanciful. You know, they really modeled this out and then made the movie. And it was the kind of theater going experience where, like, if you sneezed, everyone in the room was like, oh my God, you know, what do you have? But I think of that all the time in airports, you know, look at that. Our lives are so linked. It's not always a pleasant contemplation, like, oh good, I'm so glad. But it's true that our lives are all linked to one another. And the more we're in touch with that, the more we have this different kind of responsiveness to one another. Instead of thinking, well, you're on the outside, you know, or you don't count, or I don't have to pay any attention to you. In fact, because we're all linked, doesn't mean you have to like everybody or take everyone or anyone home with you, but it is that kind of recognition that we all have something to do with one another. Our lives have something to do with one another. And so how would we respond if we were coming more from that sense of we, rather than self and other and us and them? So it's a shift in experience because it's a shift in insight. We just start seeing things differently. And I used the example before of a tree, right? We can see the tree just as that isolated entity, the tree. Or we can look at the tree and also sense the soil, which is nourishing it, and everything that affects the quality of that soil. And the nature of the rain, which is nourishing it, and everything that affects the quality of that rainfall, and the sunlight, and so on. So we can look at that tree and also see it's part of this whole network of influences and interactions and relationship, and we understand that's a pretty big world right in that tree. That's an insight. And it doesn't mean we never see the tree as a tree anymore. But we understand that both are true. in different ways. And that if we only look at the tree as a tree, we're going to miss a lot about what that tree might need to survive. So our world, through wisdom, through understanding, actually gets a whole lot bigger as we understand more about actions and consequences, about interconnection, about constant change, about insubstantiality. And it's so unaffected. It's not like, you know, you're in some situation and you start to give yourself a lecture. Well, you know, I don't really want to pay attention to this person, but I just did this whole weekend and, you know, maybe I better act like, you know, it's not like that. But the actual way we see ourselves, we see others, it shifts, it changes, it's different because of the ways we are perceiving and the openness with which we're perceiving. And out of that insight, that wisdom, that understanding, we feel different about our choices. We still may want to go for something. Maybe it's not without quite that fervor, like this is going to make me perfectly happy and I don't care who I step on to get there, right? It could be very different. Or maybe we think, you know what? I don't need that after all. Look at that. I can be happy anyway. Maybe I'll be happier without that effort to make that other thing mine. So many possibilities. I can respond to this person in the grocery store, not as though they're a piece of furniture or an object for my convenience, but as a living, breathing human being who wants to be happy just as I do. So many ways we're changed by that wisdom, by that clear seeing, and so our behavior changes, the way we interact with one another, the way we are with ourselves, it all changes. And so that brings us right back to where we started, which was that first pillar, which is like insight, which is ethics and the ways we are, the ways we interact in the world, generosity, ethics, loving kindness. And so that's why we go round and round and round, and it all becomes this tremendously mutually supportive kind of mandala or diagram, you know, where every aspect of it is lending support and enrichment to every other aspect of it. So, do you have any questions or comments? And then I want to talk a little bit about daily practice before we end. Yeah.